From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 3 years ago, we interviewed Scott Block, chief of the Office of Special Counsel. That's the government agency that is supposed to shield civic-minded government whistleblowers from retaliation. We had him on to answer charges from watchdog groups that he was burying investigations and politicizing his office. He denied it.
Sometimes I wonder if you have to fall through the rabbit hole to live in Washington. Things seem to be turned on their head in the media. The truth is, I took an oath of office to defend whistleblowers and to take the meritorious claims and push them to the limit. And that's exactly what we're doing.
But controversy once again swirls around Block. This week, he was back in the news when FBI agents raided his home and office, seized computers, and issued subpoenas to 17 employees. One of the organizations that first blew the whistle on Block was Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Executive Director Jeff Rook says his group's complaint ultimately led to the FBI raid.
The special counsel is, as we understand it, being charged with obstructing the investigation into our complaint.
What was your original complaint back in 2005?
It was a multi-part complaint that involved purging the staff, retaliating against whistleblowers, issuing illegal gag orders, improper refusal to enforce laws, and politicizing Hatch Act enforcement. We filed this complaint back in March 2005, and we still don't have the results of that investigation. What we have is this interim step where the FBI has now intervened.
So do you suspect that there was actually criminal misconduct going on in the Office of Special Counsel?
There have been many media reports about his efforts to obstruct the investigation, prevent his staff from interviewing with investigators, as well as destroying documents on office computers. All of those could potentially fall into the realm of criminal misconduct, so yes.
Another one of Block's responsibilities was to enforce the Hatch Act, which prohibits federal employees from engaging in partisan political activity. But wasn't one of the principal charges against him that he politicized his own office?
Yes. What he was accused of doing by his own staff was blocking investigations of prominent Republicans like Condoleezza Rice and pushing investigations in the activities of prominent Democrats like Senator John Kerry.
Before we go any further, what does the Office of Special Counsel do? Is this really the High Moral Accountability Office?
He is supposed to be the guardian of the merit system, the merit system being the principles that govern federal service. And it's a very important office that Congress invested with a certain amount of independence in that the person cannot be removed by the whim of the president. He may only be removed by the president for cause. Mr. Block has told people that the White House has twice previously asked him to resign, and he's refused.
Really? Why do you think it asked him to resign?
Scott Block has been accusing the White House of being part of a gay rights conspiracy to persecute him. He took a position that the laws against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation couldn't be enforced. And it was a position that, from what we could tell, didn't match with the law and was reversed on the order of the White House. And the Bush administration is not really known to be a proponent of what some would call the gay rights agenda. And so it took a fairly extreme position for their intervention that appeared to start a cascade of bad blood that may have culminated in recent events.
We spoke to you in 2005. You said then that Block had dismissed 1,000 whistleblower cases without investigating them. Did that pattern continue despite the complaints against his office?
Well, yes. Even though it's the Office of Special Counsel, not once during Scott Block's tenure did they go to an administrative body and represent a whistleblower. So they never acted as a counsel.
Not one time?
Not one time.
You would say then that the people that he was supposed to protect, that is government employees who are trying to blow the whistle on government misconduct, could find very little aid or comfort in his office.
Whistleblowers have, in essence, been abandoned by the Office of Special Counsel, and never in the history of the federal government, in my view, have whistleblowers needed a champion more than during the Bush years. We're taking the position not only should Scott Block be fired, but Congress should consider abolishing the office and starting over again. It's to the point where this institution is now so compromised and distracted and paralyzed that it may be worse than nothing.
If you really think that maybe the office should be eliminated and we should start all over again, what kind of replacement office would you create?
We would design a system that would give the whistleblower much more autonomy over their own case and fate, rather than depending upon a federal official to come in and save them. If you gave them the options that would range through mediation to litigation to resolve their complaints and take the remaining functions of the special counsel and put it in agencies that are competent, like the GAO, or moving Hatch Act prosecutions back to the Justice Department. Certainly, for the next few months, you're not going to see anything productive out of an office where a fifth of the remaining staff have also gotten subpoenas to testify before a grand jury against the person that's supposed to be supervising them. And if you're a whistleblower that depends upon this institution, it's just a recipe for disaster.
Jeff, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Jeff Rook is the Executive Director of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility.
Last fall, an online library of web pages called the Internet Archive received a National Security Letter, or NSL, from the FBI. It's a secret demand for information, and when the government issues one, the recipient can't talk about it, can't even acknowledge that it exists, except to his or her lawyer. In this case, the FBI wanted the email address, contact information, and usage information for an Internet Archive user. The archive chose not to cooperate and instead was the third recipient of a national security letter to fight the government in court. And this week, the government settled. By now, Internet Archive co-founder Brewster Kahle is well-versed in all things NSL, but last November, when he first heard from his lawyers at the Electronic Frontier Foundation about the FBI's demand, he faced a serious decision.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation is like an ACLU for the digital world, wasn't able to call us and tell us about it. They actually had to physically come over because as part of the gag order, the lawyers representing us couldn't use the telephone to discuss this. So the EFF lawyers came over and talked to me about it, and it then put me under a gag order. I couldn't discuss it with the board, any other staff members. I couldn't even discuss the issue with my wife. I had to make a decision of whether to give patron information over to the FBI or do what libraries do and protect their patrons and go against the United States government.
It's hard to even fathom the frustration that you must have felt, but unlike almost everybody else who has gotten such a letter, you did something about it. How did that play out?
The Electronic Frontier Foundation with the ACLU and the Internet Archive decided to file suit to go and stop this demand and get some judicial review. If a judge had gone and said that they need certain information, then we would have tried to comply. But this has gone completely outside of the judicial system as it stood. So we fought back against it, and not only did they decide then to withdraw their information request, they didn't want a judge to decide whether this whole law was constitutional, so they wanted to settle. The only way that we would be willing to settle is so that we could talk about this and remove the gag order.
Now, previously, a recipient of a national security letter did litigate the matter and did win, and the court ruled that such letters are unconstitutional, but the government appealed that ruling, so the final result is pending. In the meantime, what you've done is published what you call a cookbook for how to deal with an NSL should you be unfortunate enough to receive one.
The first step is to go to one of these pro bono firms like EFF and ACLU, and you can file a lawsuit. It's legal, perfectly legal, to push back on these, to get a court to go and say whether it's actually required. And if you go through that, in every circumstance, they've been washed away. So there's now a cookbook of the forms that they use and how you can go about pushing back on these is now all up on public websites.
When you spoke to the EFF about this and discussed your options, did you consider the idea of just going public and risking prosecution from the outset?
No, the jail sentence is kind of onerous, but the wondrous thing is the EFF and the ACLU didn't blink. They said, of course we're going to help you with this. Because imagine what the alternative would be. If I'm running a library, I can't even tell anybody about this. If I started incurring legal bills, I'd have to explain it to the board. There'd be no way to deal with getting this in front of a judge without incurring tens of thousands of dollars.
And yet, when the Congress learned that the FBI has been issuing these letters indiscriminately, Congress didn't seem to get all that exercised about it. I mean, for example, this provision to date has not been repealed. Do you know of any attempts in Congress to deal with this particularly terrifying tool for federal police agency?
In 2006, they tried to make some exemptions for libraries, but then a library gets served with one of these things. It's still happening, and unfortunately, because of the hyper-secrecy of this, there have been 200,000 of these requests over a course of 4 years. So 50,000 a year are being issued, and there are only three that have actually been challenged.
The FBI apparently, when they issued the letter to you, did not regard the Internet Archive as a library. I don't know what they thought of your vast digital repository of, is it every page that has ever appeared on the Internet?
Yeah.
But they weren't thinking of it as a library. So when they settled with you, was it because the scales have finally fallen from their eyes and they realized that they have overreached and abused the national security letter privilege, or because they realized they've been caught on a technicality, oh, I guess he's a library after all?
We don't know. The speculation is that they just don't want these cases brought before a judge. And there's perfectly reasonable warrants and subpoena approaches for getting information that you need. These are just a shortcut that they use currently, and they're using it wildly. And that's the reason why we pushed back, so that people can start to see what it is that's going on out there.
All right, Brewster. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
Brewster Kahle is director and co-founder of the Internet Archive.
Coming up, a journey inside the head of a talking head.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Democratic Party primaries had another installment this week. Voters went to the polls in North Carolina and Indiana on Tuesday. And on cable news, anchors and pundits analyzed their heads off.
Welcome back to MSNBC's coverage of the Indiana and North Carolina.
The North Carolina results came in early, but NBC kept Indiana in the too close to call category into the wee hours of the morning. So, as has become its signature, MSNBC rolled out hours and hours of live coverage.
Going to Barack Obama. It's not getting worse for him by any means.
In all, it was a revealing night. Revealing, that is, about the mechanics of election night coverage. Namely, while waiting in a vast vacuum of results, how to fill 6 hours of airtime. Talk.
That's the big question, and that's a problem both for Hillary Clinton
and for Barack Obama. You heard Rachel Maddow again and again in this tape. She is one of the on-air analysts during MSNBC's live coverage. As a talking head, Maddow represents the progressive left. She hosts her own radio show every evening on Air America. And she's also David Gregory's sidekick on his MSNBC show. And she appears regularly on shows like Countdown with Keith Olbermann and The Verdict with Dan Abrams. Right now, this second, she's on the Media. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so rate Tuesday night's coverage. Did you guys, you think, in that vast 6 hours of vamping, did you think you jumped the shark, or do you think you stayed pretty much relevant through the whole ordeal?
I was riveted, but I guess that's what they pay me for. It actually became a story that we didn't have results because people were focused on what the margin was going to be in Indiana. We had instant results out of North Carolina. And the fact that we couldn't answer the question itself became a form of result. We started talking about the fact that that meant that it wasn't going to be a blowout for Hillary Clinton. That had implications. What we were able to do and what we were not able to do became part of the story that we were all covering.
I think this conversation is about what it's like to be you. How does it feel to be on live national television, pretty much in the absence of, facts, or reporting and just kind of blathering. Does that feel good? Does it feel bad? Does it feel dirty?
Some of what I do in my life is blathering, but covering election night, we are actually reacting to facts as they are brought into our discussion. The exit poll data is real. The results information is certainly real. The statements by the candidates are real. And those are the facts that we bounce off in order to create an hopefully interesting, engaging narrative about what's unfolding in political news that night. So it doesn't feel artificial to me, but I do think that what happens in cable news coverage right now on big political nights is that, you know, every Tuesday where there's an election is now a Super Tuesday. And if it's a Super Tuesday, it justifies having 40 people on set at any one time. And I think there is a real danger that the kind of alpha dog narrative of the night gets followed by everybody else. So whether it's Tim Russert or whether it's George Stephanopoulos, they give their take on what's happening, on what the story is of the night, on what direction things are going. And because we're all in a group, we're all in the same room, I think that creates a tendency to all follow that storyline. And I think I, by nature, resist that sort of thing just because of my personality. But it does often make me the contrarian in the room.
Right up till the, you know, the minute before the primary, all the talk was about Reverend Wright, Reverend Wright, Reverend Wright, Reverend Wright, which actually got under your skin. Here's you.
I find it incredible that we're all sitting here going, why won't the Jeremiah Wright controversy go away? Well, you know what? Today, John McCain unveiled his health care plan. We got three different statements, three different policies from the candidates on gas prices. We got the President of the United States making a huge economic speech and speaking to reporters for 40 minutes. We've got four Marines or four U.S. soldiers who are announced to have been killed in Iraq yesterday. What else has to happen in the news to push Jeremiah Wright out of the headlines before we do it for six straight headlines on every politics show in the country.
The thing that is least rewarding to me about television is that I don't get to decide what stories we discuss. Usually that means that I go along and I try to come up with my best take on what it is that they're throwing out there for discussion. But every once in a while, like with that tape that you've played, every once in a while, I think that the most important thing about the story that we're discussing is the fact that it is deemed worthy to discuss on cable television. And so that point is something that I'm willing to bring up. I mean, I don't think that television executives and television producers are particularly happy to hear their pundits say that. Essentially, you're questioning the production of the show.
Were you spoken to about that little tirade?
Was I spoken to about it? No, I don't have that kind of relationship with them. But I made clear that I wasn't going to play along happily with discussing every permutation of the Reverend Wright story. Ultimately, when the Jeremiah Wright coverage completely eclipsed everything else that was being discussed on the campaign trail for a couple of days, I just took myself out of the mix. And it's a decision at that point as to what my value is in the discussion. I can criticize that that discussion is happening from outside that discussion. But if nobody hears that criticism because I've taken myself off television because I think I'm above that for some reason, then nobody's going to hear my critique either. And the discussion's going to happen with or without me.
Okay. Now, on this program, we spend a lot of time criticizing, especially cable news, for fixating on stories that are dramatic but ultimately insignificant to, you know, the body politic. But what if I asserted to you that you're actually wrong about the Reverend Wright story, that while the back and forth between him and Barack Obama may not have anything to do with health care or the economy or America's standing in the world, it is a metaphor for the racial ambivalence in America and for racial tension and for a lot of the issues that undergird the entire notion of a black man running for president? Maybe it is the story of the election.
I think it is one story of the election. I think the Reverend Wright controversy is interesting. There is a discussion there to have. But I also think that the amount of coverage was excessive. I know you guys have talked about this, the Project on Excellence in Journalism report looking at the quantity of campaign coverage in the week leading up to Indiana and North Carolina. The Reverend Wright story got, I think they found 42% of the campaign coverage for that week. Hillary Clinton, everything about Hillary Clinton got 41% of the coverage. I mean, yes, the Reverend Wright story is interesting. It's not that interesting. I'm willing actually to engage with people about the Reverend Wright story to a certain extent, but I'm not willing to allow it to eclipse everything else simply because it gets good television ratings because it has tabloid value. I also think that the amount of media coverage of the Reverend Wright controversy is itself a story, because I do think that there are similarly tabloid, similarly scurrilous, similarly potential ratings magnet stories about the other candidates, particularly about John McCain and his albatross right-wing pastors, but they haven't been exploited in the same way. And that decision by the media, I think is worth interrogating, because I think it does have political implications.
As I told you, this conversation is about you, but let's for a moment talk about me. I met my wife in a bar. She was a businesswoman from Serbia, and we met, I don't know, 12 years ago. And my opening salvo was something along the lines of, what must it be like for you to go to work every day knowing the various compromises you have to make just to go about doing business in Serbia under the Milosevic regime? You know, do you come here often? This question wasn't. And I have exactly the same question for you. As a pundit on MSNBC, what compromises do you have to make day in and day out, and how do you sort that all out?
It's really only one issue. Well, no. There's a petty issue and there's a real issue. The petty issue is that I hate them dressing me up like a senator.
I
is a person.
Do you wear the American flag lapel pin?
If they could broach me, they would. Literally, it causes me psychic pain to have to put on the "I'm a high school principal, I'm a U.S. senator" outfit and get the makeup and the whole thing. That's the petty issue. The real issue is story selection, is editorial control. I can only control what it is that I get asked to speak about in a very blunt way. That said, the way that I handle that is that I am gunning to get my own show. I would really like to be hosting a show on cable television rather than guesting, because I would like to exert more control over what gets discussed, over what counts as important.
Rachel, thank you very much.
Bob, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for asking me to be on the show.
Rachel Maddow hosts The Rachel Maddow Show on Air America, and you can catch her almost all the time on MSNBC.
A big part of Hillary Clinton's pitch to the public in recent weeks has involved depicting Barack Obama as an elitist, out of touch with the blue-collar everyday voter. As the campaign winds down, it's blazed a trail through countless bowling alleys, bars, and diners. But in this effort to be down-homier than thou, Clinton may have gone a step too far last weekend on This Week with George Stephanopoulos. Stephanopoulos asked Clinton if she could name one economist who supported her plan for a gas tax suspension. She responded with the E-bomb.
Well, you know, George, I think we've been, for the last 7 years, seeing a tremendous amount of government power and elite opinion basically behind policies that haven't worked well for the middle class and hardworking Americans.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at UC Berkeley's School of Information. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you noted recently on Fresh Air that elite can mean many things.
Well, sure. There's one sense of the word where it refers just to the best of a group, the cream of the crop, and nobody has any problem with that when we talk about elite fighting forces or elite pole vaulters and things like that. There's another use of the word where it refers to the ruling class, the leaders of the financial world, and so forth. That's the sense that it has in the title of C. Wright Mills' famous book from the 1950s, The Power Elite. And there's a third sense, though all of these are connected, where it refers to the bon ton, as you used to say, a high society. For those who remember Duffy's Tavern, the old 1940s radio show, it used to begin with the manager of the tavern saying,
"Hello, Duffy's Tavern, where the elite meet to eat. Archie, the genial manager, speaking."
And yet Archie was aspiring to the very same kind of elitism that Dan Quayle condemned when he condemned sitcom character Murphy Brown for having a child out of wedlock.
Well, Quayle launched that attack in 1992, a bit before the presidential elections in that year. And he really combined two senses of elite. On the one hand, he was thinking about the elite media, academics, and so on and so forth. But there was also an implication that these people were snooty and out of touch with other people. And those two senses began to blur at that point.
Spiro Agnew, Nixon's vice president, made a big deal of the media elite. I guess it started with Spiro Agnew, but it's really gained steam on the Fox cable news network.
Right. Elite used to be used in America, and it's still used in Britain, with primary reference to the people with economic, military, and political power. So if you look at the British press, and this is left, right, or center, you'll see phrases like corporate elite, economic elite, military elite, outnumbering phrases like media elite. In America, though it used to be that way, it's now shifted so that phrases like media elite and Hollywood elite are more frequent in the media. Fox News in particular, you'll see that the media elite outnumbers some of those other phrases put together by 40-1. But it's even the case on CNN that people talk about the media elite now more than they talk about the financial or corporate elite. So the word's kind of shifted its meaning. It no longer refers simply to those who actually wield power, but rather what's alleged to be positions of cultural authority. Those are the people that the word singles out.
Jeff, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at the UC Berkeley School of Information. Dr. Drew Weston is a professor of psychology at Emory University and author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. Drew, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Is it possible that Democrats are so easily tarred with the e-brush because many of them simply are? Not that Republicans aren't.
Well, you know, it's funny because when you get to the level of presidential politics or even senator congressional politics, you pretty much have to be elite to think that you should be in that bunch. So on both sides of the aisle, it's pretty hard to be a regular kind of person and really be in that office.
And as you've noted, if this elitism narrative successfully takes hold, that's all it takes to lose an election.
That's right. And the reason is that if you look at 40 years of electoral data, what you find is that the best predictors of voting behavior, the two most important, are people's feelings towards the parties and their values or principles and their gut-level feelings towards the candidates. So if one party is presenting itself as the party of values and the other side is out of touch with the values of the people and is also tarring the candidate of the other side with the brand of this person's elite and out of touch, they've essentially got them pretty well because they've hit the two best predictors of voting behavior.
So how do politicians counter these attempts to brand them as elitist?
Bill Clinton was a good example of someone who was fighting the elitist message in 1992, and he was actually behind – he was in third place in the polls behind Ross Perot and George H.W. Bush until he came out with a biographical ad, The Man from Hope.
I was born in a little town called Hope, Arkansas, 3 months after my father died. I remember that old two-story house where I lived with my grandparents. They had very limited incomes.
The best defense is a good offense, is to get something out there fast about your own biography.
Obviously, Hillary Clinton recently has made a serious attempt to brand Barack Obama as an elitist and herself as a regular Josephine. Does her strategy resemble Bill's 1992 masterstroke?
No, in some ways it more resembles George W. Bush's master strokes against both of his rivals in trying to brand them as elitist. It's really playing with fire as a Democrat to try to brand a fellow Democrat as elitist because in many ways it's reinforcing the Republican branding of the Democrats.
But has she been successful?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at her win in Pennsylvania, she clearly took some comments that he had made that were a misstep from him and ran with them effectively and then started to retell a story of herself as, you know, Rosie the Riveter, or as you were saying, as an everyday Josephine. And in Pennsylvania, I think his counter strategies weren't very strong. The bowling fiasco when he, you know, bowled a 37, compare that to what he did before North Carolina and Indiana, where instead he was really on his home turf playing basketball. And it's a much more masculine sport that's going to appeal much more to
NBA dads?
NBA dads, exactly. You know, it's truer to them. And that's one of the other things that's just so important in politics is when – as soon as candidates start doing photo ops that don't look like it's them, it signals something other than honesty. And there's only so far you can push a narrative that isn't true.
You give us way too much credit, I think. I mean, everybody seemed to have bought George Bush's narrative as having grown up in the wilds of Texas.
Neither Gore nor Kerry ever said, you know, who is this guy pretending to be every man, to be, you know, the average Joe and to have a ranch? He just bought that ranch a year and a half before he started running for president. He went to an elite prep school, Andover. He then went to Yale. He then went to Harvard Business School. This guy's a guy who's just like you? I don't think so. Had the Democrats repeatedly attacked him for his story and offered a counter story, it probably would have stopped him from being able to get away with the, you know, I'm just like you, drinking the beer. He obviously didn't drink the beer because he was on the wagon. But
I guess there's nothing less elitist than being on the wagon.
Actually, it probably helped him in some ways. That was real. And certainly having the story about how, you know, I once was lost and now I'm found appealed to an awful lot of people.
Dr. Drew Weston is a professor of psychology at Emory University, and his book is called The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, how travel guides may lead you astray and the shrug felt around the world.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In his new book, Do Travel Writers Go to Hell? A Swashbuckling Tale of High Adventures, Questionable Ethics, and Professional Hedonism, author Thomas Konstam admits to all sorts of questionable activities, from drunken philandering to peddling ecstasy. But that's not what got critics calling his memoir the travel industry's dirty little secret. What really seems to have punched their tickets were passages that implied that Konstam cut corners, plagiarized, and traded his status as a journalist for favors. Despite a harsh blowback from many in the industry, Konstam claims that his book reveals the real world of a functioning Lonely Planet travel writer, warts and all. I'm joined now by the professional hedonist himself. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob. Nice to be here.
It is no small thing to get a review in Lonely Planet in some out-of-the-way place. All of a sudden, you're going to find this influx of young backpackers, their Lonely Planets in hand, trying to get the experience that they read about. This is a big thing for people who get a good review.
I talk about a hostel that had been in a number of guidebooks through a number of years, a Swiss-owned hostel. They were communicating, writing updates into Lonely Planet and keeping a high profile with the company. And then when the owner was out of town back in Switzerland, a local establishment stole the name of the hostel and his telephone number so that they could be the place that was featured in the guidebook. And so he came.
Thomas, you confess to a number of questionable, if not altogether sleazy, practices, but more significantly, you describe the travel writing business as rife with sleaze. Take me, please, on a brief tour of that.
The reality of a guidebook writer in the present industry is that the fees have gone down. It's very rare that there are royalties involved anymore. And it's a rotating cast of young and wide-eyed writers.
So writers such as yourself are just basically unable to fulfill the terms of the contract for the money they're getting and the time allotted to them.
People find ways to cut corners on the road, which is getting comps and freebies and trying your best in the process to maintain your objectivity.
In your writing for Lonely Planet, mm-hmm. Did you file copy that suggested to your editors and to your readers that you'd been to a place that you had never in fact visited?
Yes, of course. There were numerous establishments that I was not able to visit in person, that I collected information from trusted sources in the field and did my best to corroborate that with other information. The only illustrative details about a place that I always take without being there were usually from the last edition of the Lonely Planet book.
You talked about going back to previous editions to give what was reputedly up-to-date information.
Mm-hmm.
I myself, in my own personal experience, stayed in a hotel in St. Croix, Virgin Islands, that I'm sure once upon a time was a beautiful place. When I stayed there, I was the only occupant of the hotel on the night I was there. The place was faded, to say the least. Oh, and by the way, in returning from dinner to the parking lot, I was kidnapped at gunpoint. What was true last year, especially in the developing world, where Lonely Planet guides spend a lot of time, what happened yesterday is not necessarily a predictor of what the reality is today.
Mm-hmm.
How can you so easily dismiss the idea of cutting and pasting from a previous edition?
Now, there are inherent limitations to a paper guidebook. There's going to be a year lag pretty much between the time that that book is researched and the time that it's out on the shelf. Buying a book at Barnes & Noble is not going to safeguard you from the big crazy world out there. And people, by following these tourist trails, also going from Lonely Planet recommended hostel to Lonely Planet recommended hostel, are not necessarily going to the best ones. It's not the end all and be all, and it's not an insurance policy.
But you do understand ultimately why people are exercised about this, right? I mean, if you're owning up to not honestly representing your reporting experience, people are going to have a problem with that.
A lot of the so-called scandal or blow-up happened before the book came out. And as people have read the book and seen how I argue my points, I've had a lot of very positive feedback.
Thomas, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Thomas Konstam is the author of Do Travel Writers Go to Hell? A Swashbuckling Tale of High Adventures, Questionable Ethics, and Professional Hedonism. Lonely Planet Guidebooks, it should be mentioned, is treating this as an exceptional case and is reviewing the books Konstam contributed to and will correct any errors it finds.
So, rumor has it, Brangelina is going to be starring in an upcoming film adaptation of Atlas Shrugged, the blockbuster penned in 1957 by Ayn Rand. Or maybe just Angelina. Brad may be starring in a remake of Rand's The Fountainhead. Whatever, banker John A. Allison suggested this week on NPR that Atlas Shrugged should be required reading.
My favorite book is Atlas Shrugged, which is the best defense, I believe, of capitalism ever written.
And so the charitable arm of the bank he heads, the very large BB&T, has been offering generous grants to colleges and universities that agree to teach Atlas Shrugged. Since 2005, it's given several million dollars to a couple dozen institutes of higher learning for the study of Rand's philosophy called objectivism. Some academics don't like the conflict of interest this arrangement represents, but objectivists say it's perfectly reasonable. It certainly wouldn't have bothered Rand.
I am primarily the creator of a new code of morality, which has so far been believed impossible, namely, a morality not based on faith, not on emotion, not on arbitrary edict, but on reason. Morality which can be proved by means of logic.
And while it may not seem logical, presidential candidate Ron Paul, who subscribes to libertarianism, a political philosophy inspired by objectivism, is still winning primary votes. 16% in Pennsylvania, 8% this week in both North Carolina and Indiana, and his brand new book on the campaign is a bestseller. His fans admire both his ideas and his unwillingness to pander.
If you want my work, you must take it as it is or not at all.
Do you wish to defy our common standards?
I set my own standards.
Do you intend to fight against the whole world?
If necessary.
No, that's not Ron Paul. That's Gary Cooper playing Howard Rourke, the tall, angular architect of tall, angular buildings in The Fountainhead. That book has sold something like 6 million copies since it was published in 1943. Ron Paul should be so lucky. Rand died in 1982, but Rand lives.
Let's put it this way. Ayn Rand's work, I think, is popular for the same reason Prometheus has always been popular with humans. It's about somebody who dares to struggle against great odds and, you know, steals fire.
Nick Gillespie is the editor of Reason.com and Reason TV and former editor of Reason Magazine, a libertarian journal whose name is a nod to Rand's favorite word. Reason above all. Reason above conventional pieties. Reason above religion. Above especially collectivist societies and command economies, the horrors of which she witnessed as a child in St. Petersburg during the Russian Revolution. Reason that finds its purest expression in capitalism.
Virtually every CEO of every major company will list Ayn Rand as a major influence. A bevy of Hollywood stars ranging from Brad Pitt to Angelina Jolie to Vince Vaughn, a director like Oliver Stone, who is fond of Castro, says that Ayn Rand is one of the most important figures in his intellectual life. Martina Navratilova, Billie Jean King, Hugh Hefner. I mean, the reach of this author is pretty astonishing.
And I don't think that influence derives from her persuasive argument against command economies.
She gives egoists a positive case for why the world should revolve around them and around their efforts. If you are the person who is creating value, if you are the star, the sun really does revolve around you. And not only should it be that way, but that's the moral order of the universe.
Ayn Rand's philosophy was fundamentally selfish. Respond.
Ayn Rand's philosophy is fundamentally reality-oriented.
Jeffrey Britting is the archivist of the Ayn Rand Institute and associate producer of the documentary Ayn Rand, A Sense of Life.
Human beings live their own life. Human beings implement their own thinking. They pursue their own happiness. That's ultimately a very selfish act. And that's a virtue, in her opinion.
Ayn Rand thinks that people who raise money for other people or provide services for other people in an organized way are weak and deluded.
Absolutely not. That is a flat-out distortion of Ayn Rand from A to Z. And if you wish to see the evidence for that, please consult her novels and please consult her views on charity and please consult her views on scholarships and please consult her views on friendship and gift giving and Christmas and good cheer.
You don't like altruists.
I disapprove of them. I regard them as evil.
Phil Donahue interviewed Rand in 1980.
What's bad about the person who wants to help other people?
Well, to begin with, that's the big mistake. People can want to help other people properly and with very good reasons, but that isn't altruism. Altruism doesn't mean merely helping people. It means sacrificing yourself to others, placing the interests of others above your own. It's the self-sacrificing person who is an altruist.
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with committing suicide? What's wrong with giving up life? And why is the happiness of another person important and good, but not your own?
Although she professed to live this life of reason, she herself lived a life of turbulent unreason.
Algis Volunis is contributing editor at The New Atlantis.
She had an affair when she was 49 with an acolyte of hers, a married man who was 25 years younger than she. She expected her husband and his wife to simply accept this affair as the perfectly reasonable thing to do. And for 12 years, they spent a couple of afternoons in her bedroom each week while slowly her lover's marriage dissolved and her husband became a virtual alcoholic. And when she was 61, her lover, Nathaniel Brandon, dumped her for a younger woman and she went crazy. All this vaunted reason of hers went right out the window.
Her lover's act, though cold, was perfectly rational.
She thought that if individuals wished to show compassion, they could do so, but they were under no obligation to do so. And for the most part, she looked on compassion as something morally slovenly, a concession that the strong made to the weak at the expense of their own excellence. She writes about compassion in The Fountainhead as what you feel when you see a caterpillar squashed.
Self-sacrifice, we drool, is the ultimate virtue. Let's stop and think. Can a man sacrifice his integrity, his rights, his freedom, his convictions, the honesty of his feeling, the independence of his thought? These are a man's supreme possessions. It is the unsacrificed self that we must respect in man above all. And where do we find it? In a man like Howard Roark.
It is the unsacrificed self that we must respect in man, but not perhaps in woman.
At the center of the fountainhead is a scene of what can only be called consensual rape, in which Dominique Francone, the heroine, who is this masterful woman, but a virginal one, is overcome by Howard Roark in a scene of great passionate savagery.
She describes it as the act of a master taking shameful, contemptuous possession of her was the kind of rapture she had always wanted.
Writer Amy Benfer.
I think one of the big problems one runs into quite early, if you're a woman reading an Ayn Rand novel, is that she sort of paradoxically believed that a woman's place was to find a hero and worship him.
But as a kid, Amy Benfer slid past that part and briefly became an objectivist. She wrote a piece for In Character called Randy Girls, Adolescent Teenage Girls Love Ayn Rand. Wonder why?
Like in fairy tales, there are very few mothers in these stories. Almost nobody has a mother. Also, none of her characters have children. The female characters are extremely unencumbered by domestic responsibilities. And I also think the core idea of selfishness is sort of liberating to a teenage girl who is told that her noblest goal in life is to take care of other people.
In fact, that reminds me of a scene from The Simpsons where Marge brings little Maggie into the Ayn Rand School for Tots.
Maggie likes a bottle of warm milk before nap time.
A bottle? Mrs. Simpson, do you know what a baby's saying when she reaches for a bottle?
Baba?
She's saying, I am a leech. Our aim here is to develop the bottle within.
As research for her piece, Benfer wrote to book editors she knew trolling for opinions about Rand.
One book editor wrote back to me and said, I avoided reading Ayn Rand until I was 22. And after I finished The Fountainhead, I felt I had discovered something very important. Never date a boy who is reading The Fountainhead. Another reply I received pointed me to a fake blurb on the back of John Stewart's recent book, America, the Book, attributed falsely, of course, to Ayn Rand. And it reads, this book is similar to my works in that anyone who reads it is sure to become an asshole for at least a month afterwards.
Nick Gillespie of Reason says he was never wowed by Rand's novels, but that the attacks on them are often swipes by people who would rather not seriously engage her ideas.
How many characters from Saul Bellow novels, how many characters from Don DeLillo novels, inarguably great writers, how many of them have penetrated the American cultural consciousness in the way that a Howard Roark or a John Galt has, to a degree where these are shorthands for an entire system of ideas? I think that that speaks pretty highly of her power as a writer. She is a great author because she has a phenomenal audience, including a lot of people who go through a worshipful phase with her. And, you know, here we could be talking about Alan Greenspan, the former head of the Federal Reserve, as well as any number of pimply-faced adolescents who decide to grow beyond her.
She put the individual front and center in life and in death. Here she is 2 years before she died.
What I always thought was a sentence from some Greek philosopher. I don't unfortunately remember who it was that I read at 16, and it's affected me all my life. I will not die. It's the world that will end. And that's absolutely true. And, you know, for me now, it should be a serious question, because my time is fairly limited, and I have the same feeling that I will enjoy life to the last moment. And when it's the end, I don't have to worry about it. I'm not there. It's too bad that the world will end, and I think a very wonderful world will end with me.
There's a lot to be said for the consolation of philosophy.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alan Smith, and Nadia Zonis, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Jason Isaac and Zach Marsh. We also had help from Sasha Evans and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.